Good morning, everybody. It's Friday with Jim here at Coast Community Radio. I'm your host, Jim Wilkins, assisted ably by Terry Wilson, the engineer. Well, I'm happy to have in the studio with us today Patrick Corcoran, who is a hazard outreach specialist from Oregon State University, working here on the coast. And also today, we welcome to the studio the folks from OPB who are filming this segment. We're going to ask Pat to do a lot of doomsaying. Patrick, welcome.
Thank you, Jim.
I'd like to start out with just a brief biographical sketch of Pat Corcoran and what do you do and how do you get here?
As is your tradition, yes.
Yes.
Thanks, Jim. Well, my family's from the Midwest. I was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in St. Mary's Hospital, which is about 20 feet west of the Mississippi. So when people ask why I moved way the heck out here, I tell them it was my destiny. Went to school in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and wasn't ready to be done with that and wanted to go to graduate school somewhere beautiful, and so came out to Oregon and Oregon State University in 1985. Was lucky enough to get a job with the OSU Extension Service getting out of school. A community development specialist was my title, and at that time it was the timber troubles, and the idea was to work with rural communities to, as the Extension Service does, extend research-based information out into rural communities so local people can apply it. Through time, then, that evolved into working with watershed councils on conflict resolution and consensus decision-making and that kind of a thing. And then in 2003, I had the opportunity to come to Astoria here to do the outreach component for a NOAA-funded coastal storms program, which was looking at maps, models, and tools that could be applied here at the mouth of the Columbia to help us better predict, prepare for, and respond to coastal storms. So I literally came to Astoria for the weather. And in 2004, of course, we had the Sumatran earthquake and Indonesian tsunamis, and that is when I essentially rewrote my position to stay here in Astoria and be a hazards outreach specialist.
So exactly then what you do is go around the different communities along the coast and explain what you kind of feel is probably going to happen geologically, and then respond to questions as far as how the little communities can respond.
More formally, as an OSU Extension agent, I need to convey research-based information. So the value that I bring is what I share has been vetted not only at OSU but broader than that. And that's kind of the value added of Extension, to keep that research grounding in these topics that we don't know everything about. We can say some things but not other things, and it's important to keep that distinction.
Well, given that, Pat, how do you explain to people the inevitability of subduction zone quake and the resulting tsunami? Because there's some historical stratigraphy that's been done. Can you describe that?
The biggest challenge is people to get it, to believe it, to expect it. And like myself in 2004, I had an intellectual understanding of geology and tsunamis, but it wasn't until I saw the real deal that I realized the impact that we were going to have. Now, here in the Northwest, since Western settlement, we've not experienced what Japan or Chile have experienced. So it's understandable that culturally we're blindsided by this. And it's human nature to not kind of embrace bad news. And so a lot of what my work is about is helping us get the precognitive preparedness, if you will, about expecting this. We do live here. We have 10,000 years of geologic evidence showing us what's happened in the past.
That's what I was getting at, Pat. The original research was done at Oregon State, but tell me exactly, and a lot of it was done on Willapa Bay, exactly what did they do?
Well, a variety of researchers around the world working on things. Oregon State University, Chris Goldfinger is a researcher there, mm-hmm. and his great contribution has been to identify offshore canyons, core samples that show the inundations going back 10,000 years, sort of how big and how frequent. That's new information. We went from having, you know, real zero understanding sort of in the early 90s to having a 10,000-year research base of how many and what kind of these things have happened. In Japan, they didn't have that long of research base. They kind of underestimated what they got. But they do, by contrast, have 1,000 years of cultural history of earthquake, get to high ground, earthquake, get to high ground. So complementary examples. The work you mentioned in Willapa Bay, Brian Atwater was very instrumental in identifying when the last one was. Because once we knew when the last one was, now we have some sense of a start time. And that was 314 plus years ago that we got what Japan got, a magnitude 9 that inundated our what are now our coastal communities.
Now, when the subduction zone quake happens again, and I think you can say with some certainty that it will, what can we expect?
That's a great question, because we know that there have been 19 of these magnitude 9s in the last 10,000 years and another 20 or so magnitude 8s. They've all been different. I mean, and so the next one will be just like one of those 40, you know. So it is not like what's going to happen is exactly known. We know the structure, the what's going to actually happen in terms of the earthquake, but how big, how much water is displaced, how big the tsunamis are, is more of a range than a specific kind of elevation level. So what's going to happen next time? What we can be sure to experience is a long earthquake, slow roller earthquake, during which time we drop 3 to 6 feet due to the subsidence and probably scooch southwest 20 feet or so because the earth is relaxing and relaxing back down to the position it was 314 years ago. So in this studio, we can experience things shaking and jiggling and going on for quite a while. That will naturally trigger some landslides, damage some bridges and roads. Not all bridges and roads are going to fall, but we have to expect that they're certainly not all going to be okay. We have a number of landslides here in Astoria, some of which will definitely re-engage. And those are the main events of the earthquake and tsunami. The earthquake like that, a big earthquake like that, is everybody's warning that tsunami wave trains are likely to come ashore within a short period of time, say 15 to 30 minutes on the open ocean. But in a place like Warrenton, Astoria, of course, it would have to travel up the Columbia, maybe buying us a little more time.
Now, does the subduction happen as a result of the earthquake? Consequently, Warrenton, for example, would sink 4 to 6 feet. Would that happen before the tsunami wave got here?
The sequence is kind of a 1-2-3 punch. The earthquake happens, and the earthquaking is our subsiding, so we are lowering relative to sea level as the earthquake happens. And then the edge of the fault that's 90 miles offshore from here is the very western edge of that subduction zone. Like a fingernail, it flicks up and creates the tsunami. So we have the earthquake and the subsidence, and then the tsunami comes in while we are, as you're suggesting, already a little lower than we are today.
Now, this occurs because of the conflict between two tectonic plates, as I understand it. Can you describe that for us?
I can. The science is useful to know. It can be very technical, but I like to use analogies like you've got two rugs on a hardwood floor, and you push them close to each other, and their edges meet. They kind of push, and they bulge up, and one will overlap the other pretty soon. And if you keep pushing those rugs towards each other, there's sort of a scooching that happens, you know, of the one rug over the other. That's basically the structure of the Cascadia Fault. It's more like a burrito than it is the San Andreas Fault, which is side by side. And it's that nature of that subduction zone fault that gives us the long interval but very big and bad earthquakes and tsunamis.
Because where the faults interface, there's so much friction that they can't move smoothly. So, correct me if I'm wrong, so these forces build up until they reach the point where they need to be released.
And that is the current understanding. And, you know, had we spoken in the 80s, the scientific consensus was, well, the question was, why don't we have big earthquakes here with all our volcanoes and such like that? And, you know, trying to answer that question, there was some evidence to suggest that maybe this fault is very well lubricated and it's sort of sliding, gliding by without any friction, and that's why we're fortunate enough not to have earthquakes here. The competing theory would be we're not having earthquakes here because the plates are completely locked up. And as the plates continue to move, it's basically bulging and building power until at some point it has to release, and then we start the cycle all over again. That's the scenario that the research has confirmed.
I'm just wondering, kind of an odd question, but given the technology that we have today to drill down and do stuff down under the sea, is it possible to drill down and inject some kind of a lubricant into the system?
No. Yeah, but that really reflects, you know, our human desire to come up with a technological solution for this. We would love for this to go away, but I really kind of like to phrase our circumstance as having a diagnosis of diabetes. This isn't like having a broken arm where you get a cast and it immobile for 6 weeks and then you go back to being the way you were. Our circumstance here is very much more like a diagnosis of having diabetes. It is a condition. It is a condition that we will continue to have. Now, I know many people with diabetes that live fulfilling and fruitful lives, and they do so because they do a couple things. They acknowledge that they have the condition, and they do some hard things, like injecting insulin daily, and they do some easier things, like changing diet and exercise. Similarly with us here, you know, we might want to go inject some lubrication down in there and make it go away, but more realistically, until that solution emerges, this is a human behavior. This is a human risk perception and behavior change challenge now. The geologists have told us what to expect, finally. And so now it's up to humans to understand that and apply that to our lives. And how can we live our lives in alignment with what we know is going to happen? We have that 10,000-year history. Just because I bought a house here doesn't mean geologic processes are going to stop.
Well, I understand that, Patrick, but given the fact that it's kind of a done deal that this is going to happen, what would you recommend that people do prior to the event? How can we prepare for what's going to be a pretty confusing and dangerous time?
It will be, and we are already preparing to some degree, and I'd love to go through some of the positive things we're doing. The question becomes, are we prepared commensurate with the risk? And we're preparing, but we've got a large gap to go. So some of the positive things, though, Dogami has produced some of the best tsunami inundation maps on the planet. We now have those in possession. I view that as the greatest act of cultural significance since Lewis and Clark proclaimed Ocean in View. We now know what has happened in the past. That's a real big deal. We also have CERTs that are emerging, community emergency response teams that are working to in their neighborhoods to do things like a Map Your Neighborhood program, where your neighborhood gets together and kind of scope out who's in the neighborhood and who has what resources and who has what needs. And so there are a number of things that are moving along in the right direction. The most important thing as individuals we can do is come to a place where we expect this. I had a number of years where I intellectually understood it, but only after I went to Japan and saw what looks like Oregon devastated did I come back and really expect it. The indicator of whether someone expects it or not is whether they have a go bag in their car. I knew about this work for 7 years and talked about go bags, and again, it wasn't until I returned from Japan that I I'm putting together a go bag.
Well, what do you do when you put together a go bag?
I do what we need to do, and this is to imagine the scenario we're likely to be in. I have not been through one of these before, but I've seen and researched what's happened in other places. We need to imagine the scenario we're going to find ourselves in and then ask the question, what would I like to have with me? So as I put together my go bag, I can start with a checklist from the American Red Cross or something like that, which is fine, but there are certain things I like to have that might be unique to me. As I look at the go bags of people as I go out and workshops, I notice that women tend to emphasize chocolate and toilet paper, and men like things like knives and fire starters. So, you know, we all have our own thing we'd like to have in our go bag. For me, the purpose is if by odd chance I happen to be maybe driving and between landslides or just, you know, some unfortunate case where I can't just go up to somebody's house, I have in my bag enough to sleep in a ditch overnight. Not much more than that. I've got some clothes, some shelter, and a water purifier, and with that bag, it allows me to really relax. I take it with me, it's kind of like my pacifier, and it's a reminder that, you know, if bad things happened, I'm prepared to the extent that I can do what I can do, and I can let the rest go and live a fun life.
Well, I see by the clock on the wall that we're about halfway through the program, so I need to remind our listeners, Patrick, that this is Coast Community Radio. I'm your host, Jim Wilkins, ably assisted by Terry Wilson. And our guest, of course, is Patrick Corcoran from the Hazard Overreach Specialties from Oregon State University. Now, getting back to possible scenarios, Patrick, this event is not going to happen on any kind of a schedule. So let's assume that there's a family with mom and dad, a couple of kids. They're scattered. Kids are at school. Mom's at work, dad's at work, the event happens, how can this family reconstruct itself?
It will go a lot easier if that family had the conversation before the event happened on what the expectations of everybody are. My instructions for families, for everybody, when you feel the earthquake, duck cover and hold on. Earthquakes don't kill people. Things falling on top of their noggins kill people. Once that happens, get up, brush yourself off, and immediately move to high ground. If you're already at high ground, stay put. Once you get to high ground, mom, dad, kids, maybe in three different places, stay there overnight and find your people the next day. And that stay there overnight instruction is going to be the hardest instruction to be disciplined about. But what happens is the waves come in and out for 12 to 24 hours. You don't want to survive the earthquake, survive the tsunami, and then get caught in another tsunami going back for the wedding photos or something like that, or to go get kids at school. Understand what your school's policies are, trust that they're going to evacuate properly, and if you evacuate properly, dad evacuates properly, kids evacuate properly, the next day we can all hug each other. But it will take that prior communication and understanding about what we need to do.
You know, we know that 14,000 years or so ago, the Great Missoula floods came hurtling down the Columbia Gorge and scoured the Columbia River Channel and basically cut out the toe of the hillsides that hold up Astoria. And now we see ground movement around Astoria. When this event happens, is it going to increase the probability of landslide?
Sure. I mean, especially if it's in the middle of a wet winter. The actual event in the first little while afterwards is pretty dark. I mean, during the earthquake, landslides will slide, gas lines will break, power lines will arc, fires will occur. But not everything is going to fall down and break and catch on fire. As people, we need to be aware that that's the circumstance, and we will be migrating uphill, avoiding landslides and things that are on fire, and going to homes that will be standing. And on the coast, wood frame homes will do fairly well in the earthquake, getting out of the inundation zone, getting up into the neighborhoods that are high enough. We will then be able to welcome our neighbors and expect that they'll be coming up. In each of our homes, we have in situ already food in the pantry, medicine in the medicine cabinet, and beer in the fridge. And so we have resources already. If we think of it like that, then it really brings the motivation to get to high ground. That is the motivation. Stay there overnight. Reconnect with your loved ones the next day.
But if I understand correctly, Patrick, this event is going to be so catastrophic, if I could say it, that transportation is going to be severely impacted. And we're reliant on trucks and stuff to bring food, for example, to the stores. All of that's going to be interrupted. And I'm curious about the point of those deliveries, usually in Portland, some along the interstate. How much impact will there be along the I-5 corridor from, obviously, the earthquake? The tsunami won't get there, will it?
Nope. It depends. And again, what we can say scientifically, it's sort of like winter storms next year. Jim, I can tell you we're going to have a couple, three winter storms next year with winds of 30 to 50 and an inch or two of rain. I guarantee you that with a high degree of certainty. I can't tell you what day or how wet. Same thing with the earthquakes. Now that we know the worst case scenario, it has been presented to us, we have that worst case scenario in our mind as the only scenario. I'm concerned about what's going to happen next time. We've had these 19.9s, so we're waiting for the 20th. Now, there's no guarantee that that 20th is going to be equal to or greater than the worst we've ever experienced, which are reflected in our maps. So what I'm trying to say is, when envisioning the future scenario, we can expect it to be bad on a range from bad to ugly. We may well get a magnitude 8-point-something off the south coast, which would be more like the Chilean experience, where there were, you know, a dozen people killed and there was certainly damage, but not widespread total lights-out destruction. So the next event will be somewhere along that spectrum from bad to ugly. If it's only bad, some of the things you're talking about are not going to be that affected, transportation corridors, that kind of a thing. If it's ugly, then it will be pretty much zero communication between us and Portland. We do, however, have a huge Pacific Ocean, and we have military bases in San Diego and Honolulu, which when this event happens here, for them it will be a distant tsunami. They'll need to leave port. I would love for them to come up to Seaside and do a reverse Normandy and take us off the beach onto the ships and then go to Honolulu or San Diego for a couple of months. I mean, I think we could all probably use that about then. So, yes, it'll happen along a range. We need to prepare for the worst, but also realize that it might not be the very worst we can imagine. And that helps give me some hope.
Now, the subduction zone earthquake is an event that's just going to happen. There's nothing we can do besides possibly pumping lubricant down in there, which you kind of scorn. Another event that's happening to us is called climate change. And this is an event that's ongoing. There's something that we can do about it ourselves. How is climate change going to interact with the earthquake scenario?
Interesting question. Basically, there is no direct interaction. But what's interesting is the same tectonic process that's kind of that locked plates that are rising the coast before we fall, that tectonic uplift is rising our coastlines at just about the same rate as global sea level rise. So in fact, north of Mendocino, California, in Oregon, we are rising the same rate as sea level rise. And so sea level rise per se is less of an effect here. Now, when we get our subduction zone earthquake and we drop 3 to 6 feet, we will essentially get a century's worth of sea level rise in the 3 to 5 minutes it takes for the earthquake. You understand? We're bulged up now. We'll relax. We'll re-equilibrate, our water levels that will be equal. So we have good news and bad news on the climate change and the sea level rise, at least. We're rising for now at the same rate, but when the earthquake happens, we're going to get it all at once.
Yeah, and these changes in elevation are something that we're able to measure now at this time. Is that correct?
ODOT measures 101 elevation, and so you can see the data from the ODOT measurements, very exact measurements, and that's how they're measuring this tectonic uplift.
What other kind of messages do you bring with you when you're talking to community groups?
That resilience builds community, that this can be a scary thing, but it's also something, get together, chat about it, identify the unknowns and kind of take the boogeyman away and realize the direct threat, and then we can work as neighbors on Map Your Neighborhood programs, understanding who's vulnerable in your community, and through the course of that, we're talking to each other and our neighbors. If nothing else, an excuse to have neighbors talking to neighbors, that's an important fact.
Now, Cannon Beach is doing some proactive things regarding this issue. Can you describe what they're doing down there? There was talk about building their city hall up on piling.
Yes, and I think, as coastal communities, need to explore all options and do benefits and costs and kind of balance the technological solutions and the behavior change kind of approaches. Cannon Beach has been very progressive on this. Manzanita is also very well. The Nehalem Bay Emergency Volunteer Corps is an example for, others to emulate. But each community is doing something. Each community is taking it seriously along the Oregon coast. Some have more capacity and resources and ideas to do more than others, but we are learning from each other. Cannon Beach, for example, has the caches up in the woods, and that's something other communities are starting to look at. Communities in Waldport and Lincoln City have moved their schools up out of the inundation zone. In Clatsop, we tried that once, and sooner or later we will, also move schools uphill. So each community is doing some things. Cannon Beach has definitely been a leader.
Terry, go ahead.
Well, something that hasn't been brought up yet, and I was part of that 2007 hurricane. I am a member of the first search team in Astoria. When I drive around now, I use what Pat describes as situational awareness. What I mean by that is if I go out to Fred Meyer or wherever, you look around. If it happens right now, what do I do? My wife is at home. The pets are at home. And this, what will happen will be just like the 2007 storm, except no houses collapsed then. But our bridges will be down. I won't be able to get home. Young's Bay will be down. The old Young's Bay will be down. You want to get back home? You have to drive through 26 to Portland and come back. John Day Bridge will be down. You may not get here. If you remember the 2007 storm, we had no communications whatsoever. We didn't lose any bridges. We will, probably. So
And in the 2007 storm, we came together as a community.
Oh, yes.
We helped each other. We ate lots of the beans and rice that was in our cupboards for a long time and kind of cleared that out. And we came together as a community, and we're still referring to that event and still doing things with that in mind.
I recall that storm very well. 8 days without power.
Oh, yeah.
Fortunately, Pat, I did have plenty of beer.
Good, yes. And fortunately, you were my neighbor.
That's right. I forgot to that mention that. Patrick and I were neighbors for years.
And I would always, in the evening, enjoy when he was playing banjo on his deck, listening to that beautiful sound wafting through the lovely Astoria coastal atmosphere. I really kind of want to come around and say this is a fantastic place to live. I moved here. I bought a house. I've gone through Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of death and dying, the denial, the anger, the depression, the acceptance, and I understand the risk. I've got my go bag. I expect it to happen someday. It might not happen for 50 years or even 100 years, but if it happens tomorrow, I'm prepared to do what I can in that situation, and I'm really sanguine about the situation. It's the fear of the unknown that I think is most scary. Once you wrap your head around it, even though it's bad, I want to also underscore in Japan, 90% of the people effectively evacuated the inundation zone. Tragically, 20,000 or so are dead or missing, but there were 200,000 people in the inundation zone at that time. So that 90% evacuation success is a goal for us. We can get there. We can do that.
But can we really do that, Patrick, with, let's take, for example, Warrenton. They get the notice that there's been a earthquake, they can feel the earthquake, they know they got 15 or 20 minutes to get somewhere. They all jump in their cars, all of a sudden, gridlock. So how do you organize the transportation?
Well, there will be no organization, and people may or may not be able to drive their cars. I think cars are a good plan B. I mean, look, if this event happens and you can obviously get in your car and go to high ground, I mean, people are going to do that no matter what I say. But we might not be able to drive cars. And so that's why we need to find that high ground near where we live, work, play, pray, shop. So wherever we are, we know where the closest high ground is. And if we have to hike up there by foot, we can do so.
And you recommend building some kind of a shelter up there to get to? Or
There's classical and jazz. Classical approach is linear and scripted, and we do this when we put the shelter there. But when the earthquake happens, you know, we don't know if that shelter fell down or whatever. So jazz is more of you have principles, survive the earthquake, get to high ground, stay there overnight. And we may have to go to a different high ground than we originally intended. Maybe a landslide was in the way. So that situational awareness, the understanding that I'm going to have to make some choices in the moment, maybe I take my car, maybe I don't. These are some of the things that we need to think through now so when the event happens, we're less paralyzed by that.
So the analogy of jazz then would be a lot of improvisation.
That's correct, based on certain principles. Get to high ground, stay there overnight. What's your exact route? Is it the exact arrows that are on the map? Well, maybe, but maybe not. Maybe you're just going to skedaddle across that field and up to the top of that hill and call it good.
Well, it's been wonderful talking with Patrick here. We're just kind of winding down. We've got 1 minute left, Pat. Any final thoughts? And also, we'd like to thank OPB for being here with us today. Got a few final thoughts here to finish up?
I do. Having spoken to lots of people on the coast about this for a number of years now, I think, you know, it's an important thing. On the one side, I want to give the 2x4 to the forehead that we've had 19 of these big bad boys and the 20th will come, but also want to be generous to people, you know, especially be the generations of people that lived here and never felt a big earthquake. It's totally understandable that we don't just embrace this. It's human nature. The important thing to do is to align our behavior today with what we know is going to happen.
Well, human nature, I agree with you that it's difficult for people to envision threats that are far off. If a lion comes running through this door right now, we're going to respond. And so that aspect of human nature is definitely true.
We are neurologically challenged. We have that fight or flight, you know, response drilled into us. We don't do well with things like 300-year recurrence interval events. But we're smart enough to know they're going to happen. Let's align our behavior accordingly.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's been Friday with Jim here at Coast Community Radio. I'm your host, Jim Wilkins. We've been joined by Patrick Corcoran today talking about earthquakes and stuff, and also with folks from OPB. Thanks for being here. Talk to you next week.